I have to make a confession of guilt, perhaps, which is something that Presbyterians do a lot. The confession is, I'm only a recent convert to the Psalms. Attending academic sessions on the Psalms, such as at the Society of Biblical Literature, has always been a bit overwhelming to me, because to follow the conversation, you pretty much need to have a firm grasp of identifying the Psalms' numbers and their particular themes and characteristics. So you'll have various psalm numbers, 35, 113, mentioned in discussion, and it's simply assumed that you know which ones they are. And that's always a bit intimidating to me, because, of course, with 150 psalms, that represents a pretty large number. Not to mention the extra canonical psalms that are attested at Qumran and in the Septuagint and Syriac versions. And that reminds me of a story. The story of the prisoner who was transferred to Alcatraz Penitentiary in San Francisco. His name was Bob. And during dinner one night, one of his fellow inmates stood up and shouted, 94. And when he said that, the whole dinner crowd burst into laughter. Soon thereafter, someone else cried out, 115. And again, there was uproarious laughter and applause. And this went on for about a half an hour till dinner was over, and Bob was pretty befuddled about this, so he asked his inmates what this all was about. And he told him, since we are together for such a short period of time and we really have no other means of entertainment, we have all memorized a long list of jokes and assigned them numbers, so that all we do is call out the number and everybody knows the joke. So Bob, the diligent man that he was, decided to memorize that long list, meditating on it day and night. And next dinner time, he was ready. The joke sharing session started over dinner, and someone stood up and said 15, and everybody laughed. And then somebody else said 63, again, uproarious applause. And Bob began to muster up his courage, and he decided to stand up, and he did. And he stood up and called out 23. Dead silence. And Bob sat down pretty embarrassed, and after dinner was over, he asked his friend why nobody laughed at number 23. And his friend put his arm on his shoulder in a pastoral fashion and said, well, Bob, as you well know, it all depends on how you tell it. Last night, I tried to tell a few things about Psalm 1, focusing on the tree as its central metaphor. The tree stands, I argued, at the threshold of the Psalter, conceived literally as sort of a sanctuary, a refuge, a path, an entrance into the Psalter, marked by the tree in the same fashion as the tree pillars flanked the vestibule of the temple. But there's more. I thought more about a question that was posed last night about the relationship between Psalms 1 and 2. These two are very different psalms, yet they are closely tied together, and together they serve as the introduction to the Psalter as a whole. The first psalm, as you all know, is about Torah, the law, and presents the serene image of the tree. Psalm 2 is very different. It talks about a king established on Zion in the midst of the uproar of the nations conspiring against to overthrow him. And in the process, the king is conferred or reconferred with his royal status by God. You are my son. Today I have begotten you, is God's declaration to the king. And it's a formula that's reiterated in abbreviated form in the Gospels, particularly at the time of Jesus' baptism, as well as his transfiguration. Now, there are some political implications by bringing these two psalms together and letting them together serve as the introduction to the Psalter as a whole. With the juxtaposition of these two psalms, what you have wedded together is law and king. What do law and king have to do with each other? Well, a lot, in fact. And there is clear precedent given in a piece of Pentateuchal legislation in Deuteronomy Deuteronomy 17, in which we find among the many restrictions placed upon the king in his exercise of the royal office, only one positive command. In Deuteronomy 17, verse 18, we read of this positive command, namely, to read a copy of the law all the days of his life. The king is bound to the law. The king embodies the law. He can neither act with impunity nor exalt himself above other members of Israel, all of whom are bound by covenant. So it's very important to bring law and king together, as these two psalms do as introduction to the Psalter. And was also mentioned last night, there is a certain Christological flavor to Psalm 2, for sure, particularly as the authors of the Synoptic Gospels used that pronouncement from God, as well as other usage found attested in the early church. But what about Psalm 1? Is there anything Christological about the first psalm? Well, that question led me last night to reflect a little bit on the suffering servant songs in Isaiah. The suffering servant songs, the servant songs, were foundational to Christology in the early church. And in particular, the fourth servant song, Isaiah 53, verses 2 and 3, we find this. For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering and acquainted with infirmity. A young plant that flourishes not among flowing streams, but on dry ground, without majesty, a man of suffering. And yet, it is this image of the tree, of the plant, that is applied to Christ as the arbor mundi, the cosmic tree, whose cross is made from the same wood. And so that's why, in part, we lift up high the cross of Christ as a symbol not only of Christ's death at Golgotha, the Rock of Ages, but also as a symbol of life that overcomes the wormwood and the gall, death itself. And so as Torah becomes the surrogate for Zion in Psalm 1, so Christ, we proclaim, is the one who has fulfilled the law without abrogating it and has set us on the path of life eternal. Well, you can see how a study of metaphor can lead you in many different directions, and maybe sometimes get you into trouble, because much of it may be just simply free association. But I would submit that much of it is also inspired. Well, so much for Psalm 1 and last night. Let's move on to Psalm 19. It's a psalm that I think is worth taking a look at, perhaps even memorizing, or at least becoming familiar with the characteristics so that you know that this psalm is number 19, for what that's worth. C.S. Lewis regarded Psalm 19 as, quote, the greatest poem in the Psalter and one of the greatest lyrics in the world. Well, I would say that's a pretty good recommendation. And it's said not without good reason. The psalm practically bursts at the seams with hymnic power. It limns a world rife with metaphor and myth, while imparting a formative context for sustaining obedience amid the crisis of temptation. As in our investigation of Psalm 1 last night, I want to focus on identifying its central metaphor and delineate the complex web of associations it generates both within and beyond the psalm. And so, let's go ahead and turn on the overhead projector, and I'm going to read my own translation of Psalm 19, the whole psalm. Sheila only read the first seven verses. It begins, "To the leader, a psalm of David. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament is proclaiming God's handiwork. day to day discharges speech, and night to night imparts knowledge. Although there is no speech, nor are there words, their sound cannot be heard. Yet throughout all the earth, their lines extend out, as well as their words, to the end of the world. For the Son, God, has set a tent in the heavens. Like a bridegroom, it bursts out of its wedding canopy. Like an athlete, the sun rejoices in sprinting its course. From one end of the heavens it goes forth, and its circuit is completed at the other end. There is nothing hidden from its heat. The Torah of Yahweh is complete, reviving the soul. The testimony of Yahweh is sure, educating the simple. The precepts of Yahweh are upright, gladdening the heart. The commandment of Yahweh is lucid, giving light to the eyes. The fear of Yahweh is radiant, enduring forever. The ordinances of Yahweh are firm. They are altogether righteous. They are more desirable than gold, more than abundant fine gold. Sweeter also than honey, drippings of the honeycomb. Indeed, your servant is enlightened by them. In observing them, there is great reward. Who can discern my errors? From hidden sins, clear me. Even from presumptuous thoughts, deliver your servant. Let them not gain mastery over me. Then I will become blameless and innocent of great transgression. May the words of my mouth be a pleasing offering, and the meditation of my heart be acceptable before you, Yahweh, my rock and redeemer. As I've tried to illustrate in this translation, the psalm is easily divisible into two parts, if not perhaps three parts, according to theme, style, and meter. And its very divisibility has caused many a biblical scholar, as one might expect, to wonder about its literary integrity. Verses 2 through 7 depict creation as it reflects and communicates God's glory, whereas verses 8 through 11 narrow the focus to describe the moral and salutary contours of Torah, the law. And the final verses conclude the psalm with a petition, signaled by the language of direct address. Not unexpectedly, the case has been made that these parts were originally two separate, discrete liturgical pieces. The first adapted from an ancient Canaanite hymn to the sun, and the second, an ode to Torah, culminating with a prayer. Such a diachronic or historical accounting of the psalm's formation may well be true, but it would be unfortunate to claim that these separate parts have been artificially linked together. To the contrary, the choice of metaphor and particular terminology suggests a remarkably tight coherence that cuts across literary divisions while undercutting the modern rational tendency toward bifurcating nature and law. Elsewhere in the Psalter, one finds an inseparable theological relationship between creation and Torah, as one finds in Psalms 119 and 147. In Psalm 19, however, one particular image comes to the fore, and it holds the key to the psalm's unity and message: the sun. Overall, the psalm moves from the top down, beginning with the heavenly realm and concluding with an earthly petitioner. The heavens and the firmament, that is, the realm of transcendence bounded by the domed sky, burst with discursive power, proclaiming God's glory. And this is not some constant hum like random radio waves emanating from outer space. Rather, there is explosive drama in this cosmic declaration of divine glory. And it is driven home in the first part of verse 3, Yom LeYom Yabia in the Hebrew. The verb literally means to cause to bubble up. In the case of the fool's discourse, the verb is employed to describe the fool's mouth belching forth folly. So more akin to a geyser than to tender speech or background static noise, day-to-day discharges speech. Both day and night, the primal divisions of time itself erupt with testimony of God's glory. Day and night, the heavens and the firmament all have a voice bearing witness to God's praiseworthy presence. Yet, such words, such discourse is inaudible. There is speech, but unlike anything within earshot. The celestial voices, the music of the spheres, if you will, are perceived visually vis-a-vis human perception. Creation's voice cannot be heard, yet it can be beheld by sight. Otherwise, the psalmist would have nothing to say about what creation itself says. A paradox, this paradox of the visual but silent voice, begs the question, what is the vehicle for this nonverbal discourse of the cosmos, which issues forth to the ends of the earth? I'm glad you asked that question. The answer is given in verses 5 to 7, where we find the psalmist focusing on a singular image, one that, in fact, has all to do with the regular rhythm of day and night, and is thick with associations, the sun. From a literary standpoint, the sun constitutes the central and governing metaphor of the psalm. It serves as a bridge that unites the literary components of the hymn or prayer, thereby conjoining the rhythms of the cosmos with the contours of law. As the psalm's central image, the sun, in its regular revolutions, constitutes the vehicle of cosmic discourse, the bearer of God's glory. By describing the sun in such a way, the psalmist raises the level of analogy to that of metaphor, specifically simile. Like a bridegroom and an athlete, the sun bursts forth from its wedding canopy, from its chamber to run its trek across the sky. The celestial orb literally explodes on the scene with virility and joy as it arcs from one end of the heavens to the other. Its heat penetrates all hidden things. The day is its victory lap. The night is its Sabbath. But a question remains. What is this discourse that is transmitted by the sun? Whatever it is, it's an inaudible voice turned vibrant and visual. Now, the sun's prominence in this Torah psalm may seem peculiar to modern readers, but in fact, in point of fact, there is nothing much that is innovative here, particularly in light of other testimonies in the Psalter. In biblical tradition, and more broadly in ancient Near Eastern literature, God is frequently portrayed and perceived as an effulgence of light, what scholars have referred to as a solar theophany. Indeed, it is not hard to find various psalms that relate the individual's direct experience of the divine to solar imagery. Several psalms, for example, employ the language of seeing God or beholding God's face, which is frequently associated with light or shining. In contrast to storm imagery, which is used frequently to refer to God and connotes darkness and turmoil of the divine mysterium tremendum, light bears an eminently salutary association with God, as can be seen in Psalm 27. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Or Psalm 43. You are the God in whom I take refuge. Why have you cast me off? O Lord, send out your light and your truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill and to your dwelling. Or Psalm 104. You, O Lord, are clothed with honor and majesty, wrapped in light as with a garment. So, if you want to talk about God's clothes, its light. Psalm 84, which conveys the psalmist's deepest longing for an experience of God in the temple, revels in solar language. For a day in your courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere. I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than live in the tents of wickedness. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. God bestows favor and honor. No good thing does the Lord withhold from those who walk uprightly. God is a sun and shield. Whether as an epithet or not, the image of the sun operates on much of the same rhetorical level as the more common metaphorical label for God in the Psalms, the rock. The psalm presupposes the setting of a pilgrim longing for the experience of God in the temple and speaks of the God of gods, or Most High God, being seen in Zion as a sun and shield. The association of the sun with divine presence, in short, has its home in royal temple theology. Now, confirmation, there is confirmation that an actual solar cult was operating within the precincts of the temple. And critical confirmation of this can be found in the harsh polemics of the Deuteronomistic history and in the book of Ezekiel. Among his various cultic reforms, we read that Josiah removed the horses that the kings of Judah had dedicated to the sun. Then he burned the chariots of the sun with fire. 2 Kings 23, verse 11. Apparently, it had been standard temple practice, for solar symbols to be displayed at the entrance to the temple. Archaeological remains also attest to an apparently related widespread motif of the sun. Numerous horse figurines with a sun disk situated above their heads have been discovered at Iron Age levels at Lachish, Hazor, and Jerusalem. And now I want to start showing some slides. So if someone would please turn off the overhead, and here we go. If you could, thank you very much. Also well known is the uppermost register of the 10th century cult stand from Tanakh, which similarly displays a sun disk above the body of something. Do you all see the sun disk there? What do you think that's above? Or what's below it? If you know, then you qualify to be an archaeologist, because we're still not sure exactly what it is, but theories abound that it's a quadruped, some four-footed animal, but is it a horse, or is it a cow, or is it something else? I'm tempted to think it is a horse, in line with other archaeological remains in which we actually had clay figurines of horses with the sun featured above its head, and in connection with Josiah's reform, which refers to throwing away the horses dedicated to the sun, as we find in 2 Kings 23. Well, similarly, Ezekiel looks with disgust as he beholds in a vision certain abominable temple practices, including one involving solar worship in the temple. Ezekiel 8:16. There, at the entrance of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, prostrating themselves to the sun toward the east. Well, indeed, typical of Syro-Palestinian temple architecture, the eastern orientation of the Jerusalem temple would naturally lend itself to such practice. Next slide, please. Okay, there's a photograph of a model of the temple's facade. It is facing eastward, and so where you're sitting, you're in the position of the sun as it's rising. As the sun rose over the Mount of Olives, it invariably struck the main entrance to the temple, penetrating and illuminating its interior, reflected by the layer of gold that covered much of the inside. Next slide, please. This is a reconstruction that's featured next to the so-called Holy Land Hotel in Jerusalem. Anyway, you can see the sun is pouring in, so you can see the shadow from a tree nearby. But metaphorically speaking, with the rising of the sun, you have this regularized entrance into the temple, representing the dramatic arrival of divine glory. Now, there's an interesting, in Syria, there's been found the remains of a temple foundation. It's called Ein Dara, wherein at the entrance into the temple, we find this imprint. Next slide, please. You see something at the bottom? It's not Bigfoot. It's clearly a symbol of a divine being who is walking, if you will, entering into the temple. Well, it's probably Baal or Baal. But the remains of the temple, the foot is situated towards the entrance into the temple, and the remains you see on the slide. It's not just one foot, in fact. Next slide. 3 feet. And the imprints are much larger than any human foot, so it must be of a divine being. It's not a baby's foot that sometimes when there's wet cement somewhere, we put our hand in to commemorate our presence. But no, this is the symbol of a divine being. Again, probably the god Baal, although others have suggested Ishtar, the goddess. But Ishtar, in most iconography, always wears shoes. So we're looking for a barefoot god. Well, in any case, given the temple's eastern orientation, the temple, in effect, routinized and enshrined what was historiographically conveyed in the earliest reference to solar epiphany in the Hebrew Bible, or Old Testament, namely Moses' testamentary blessing in Deuteronomy, where we read, "The Lord came from Sinai and dawned upon Seir, upon us. God shone forth from Mount Paran. With him were myriads of holy ones, at his right a host of his own." This hymnic poem attributed to Moses, which likely predates the existence of the temple, recounts Yahweh's entrance into Canaan from Sinai across the southeastern highlands of Edom, referred to here as Seir, as nothing short of a solar theophany. Although the evidence is meager, it is plausible to suggest that the use of solar imagery was indigenous to temple worship during much of the monarchy, but fell out of favor under Josiah's reign, although it persisted in some form until the temple's destruction and continued among more popular circles through the Persian and Hellenistic periods. The sun, moreover, continued to provide an especially evocative image of God's salvific activity, as we read in Malachi, the last book in the canonical Old Testament, the Christian Old Testament, in Malachi chapter 4, verse 2. "But for you who revere my name, the sun of righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings." The sun of righteousness, that's spelled S-U-N. Okay, let's turn on the lights again and shut off the projector for a moment. And, okay, great. No, that's fine. But while the image of the sun in liturgical context presupposes the setting and ethos of the temple, what is particularly notable in Psalm 19 is that the author fails to stress such a connection as other psalms do. The voice of royal temple ideology, so prominent, for example, in the Psalms of Vigil, is by and large muted in comparison. Instead, the psalmist shifts gears to focus the reader's attention on the efficacy of Torah. A close reading of the second section finds that the move from a cosmic to a forensic frame of reference is hardly abrupt, for it is the image of the sun in particular that holds together both thematic frameworks or levels of association. The solar image serves as the linchpin that unites at least two levels, or more accurately, movements of reading the psalm, one that maintains the reader's attention to the sun's image as it casts its rays upon the Torah section that follows, and one that also looks back at such imagery through the lens of Torah. Law and sun, in effect, operate as two distinct filters, because they are metaphors, by which to read and understand the psalm. The first movement involves the normal process of reading forward from sun to Torah. However, the second level, the second movement, entails reading backward or rereading the solar imagery through the lens of Torah, both indicating reading strategies elicited within the psalm through its creative use of metaphor. So, let's first read forward. As the image of the sun burns bright at the conclusion of the first section in verse 7, the light of solar imagery continues to shine in the psalmist's reflection on Torah. Solar imagery, in effect, undergirds and directs the efficacy of the law. As the sun, full of strength and joy, makes its trek across the domed sky, penetrating the darkness with its rays, so Torah performs an enlivening function within the heart of the reader. Indeed, many of the adjectives applied to Torah in the latter half of the psalm are given new focus, as if they were given a more brilliant level of meaning in conjunction with the image of the sun. In verse 9, we read, "The commandment of the Lord is lucid, giving light to the eyes." The adjective in question, bara in Hebrew, connotes moral purity and cleanness, and it's an appropriate description of a body of law. But under the purview of solar imagery, however, the Torah's efficacy is enhanced and thereby enabled to convey a sense of radiance that imparts light to the eyes. The same can be said of another descriptive adjective of the law found in verse 10. The fear of the Lord is radiant, enduring forever. Now, the word for radiant, tehara, connotes ceremonial cleanness and moral purity. In addition, the term can also connote physical purity, even luster, as in connection with the gold furnishings of the tabernacle. In other words, in Psalm 19, Torah, the law, is irradiated by the brilliant light of the sun. Other qualifiers in this section stress Torah's perfection, as in verse 8, and reliability, as in verse 10. And they become all the more suggestive as they are underscored by the rhetorical power of the sun described in the first section. Hence, Torah's perfection lies in its completeness and sufficiency, analogous to the sun's completion of its daily trek across the heavens. Under the light of the sun, Torah becomes cosmically expansive, totalizing in its scope. Like the sun, nothing is hidden from its purview. As the psalmist himself or herself declares from a poignantly personal standpoint in verse 12, "O Lord, your servant is enlightened by your ordinances. From hidden sins, clear me." The verb for enlightened in verse 12 functions as a double entendre. The psalmist is both warned and given light, hence enlightened or illumined by the law. Thus, as much as the sun penetrates the world with its all-encompassing light, Torah searches out the dark and turgid impulses of the soul, leaving nothing outside its purview, and as it were, burns them off. That is to say, the psalmist enlists the life-sustaining power of the sun, in order to highlight the restorative power of Torah, which revives the soul, verse 8. The enlivening function of Torah is fully consonant with and underscored by the image of the sun profiled in the first half of the psalm. The sun exudes energy and strength as it sprints across the heavens, providing inspiration and a model for the follower of the law. As the sun is cast in the image of a young man, specifically an athlete, so Torah is profiled as a source of renewal and strength. And here we need to go back to the slide projector. An interesting parallel, although it may be indirect at best, is found, now I need to find my light, there it is. An interesting parallel is found among the, we need to go to the next slide, thanks, is found among a number of ivories and seals of the 8th century in Israel, both of northern and southern provenance, which draw from Egyptian iconography and profile the sun god as a child, sometimes combined with the image of the lotus plant, the traditional symbol of regeneration in the Old Kingdom. The image of the sun child, which achieved predominant status in the New Kingdom, may lie behind this claim in our psalm of Torah's restorative capacities, insofar as the law reflects the renewing force of the sun. In any case, the soul, and thus the individual's very being, is in effect rejuvenated, made young for the task of obedience, and empowered to follow the prescribed path of righteousness. In short, the sun's image sheds new light on the attributes of Torah. Or to speak more literally, the sun lends empowering nuance to the law. Like the sun, which energetically runs its course across the heavens, Torah revives the soul. Its precepts gladden the heart, and its commandment enlightens the eyes. Israel's Torah is as lucid and firmly established in the heart of the community as the sun is radiant and permanently fixed in the heavens. As the radiant purity of the dawn penetrates the darkness, making possible even perception itself, so the law educates the simple and more profoundly informs and guides the conduct of the community of faith, which reveres its creator. As the sun is superlative in might, ruling the day, so Torah is a source of moral strength and the supreme object of delight, surpassing material wealth and sensual delights. This law, my friends, is no burden. It is rendered effulgent with prescriptive and enlivening power. Far from afflicting the reader, Torah quickens the languishing soul and the morally dead. Like the temple's gilded interior reflecting the dawning of the sun, the law imparts power, figuratively solar power, to the reader of Psalms, providing thereby inspiration for obedience. Analogous to the cosmos, Torah's discursive power imparts nothing short of divine glory. Okay, that's what you get from reading forwards. But now, the psalmist beckons us to read backwards. By explicating the Torah in solarized fashion, the psalmist also turns the tables by inviting reflection on how the sun reflects Torah's ethos, prompting a rereading of the first section in light of this central context. If the commandment of Yahweh gives light to the eyes, as the psalmist wants to claim, then with Torah serving as both lens and light, all of creation should somehow look differently, including the sun. Through the filter of Torah, the sun becomes re-inscribed as a cipher of righteousness. To put it crassly, as Torah is solarized, so the sun is Torahized. That is, the solar image is recast into a forensic figure. The sun is transformed into a multi-layered metaphor for both Torah and its disciple. Most notable is the reference to the sun's trek, or path, in verse 6, which connotes in both sapiential and legal literature moral, faithful conduct. Figuratively speaking, the Son models the path ordained by God that all are to follow. As laid out explicitly in Psalm 119, the so-called Psalm of the Law, happy are those who keep God's decrees, who also do no wrong, but walk in God's ways. To walk in the way, that's what the Son does. The Son provides a cosmic model and inspiration for following, literally in the path of Torah. Moreover, the Son does more than simply walk. It sprints. Like the Son, the follower of Torah displays strength, joy, and penetrating discernment. Like an athlete, the one who abides by Torah obeys with untiring alacrity, rejuvenated by the enlivening spirit symbolized by the Son that courses through every ordinance and precept of the law. In sum, the Son not only evokes the ethos and efficacy of the law, it also embodies and models Torah piety. Now, the historical and theological relationship between solar imagery and the law is by no means an innovation on the part of the psalmist. The inextricable link between sun and law clearly predates the psalm by at least a millennium. Next slide. In Mesopotamia, the sun god Shamash was considered the source and preserver of the social order, as conveyed through codified law. For example, the famous stela that features the Code of Hammurabi depicts the sun god giving the law or commissioning its codification to Hammurabi of Babylon. In Hammurabi's own words, by the order of Shamash, the great judge of heaven and earth, may my justice prevail in the land. As a devotee of Shamash, the king refers to himself as the king of justice to whom Shamash committed law. You see, Hammurabi was not very modest. As Shamash's representative, Hammurabi effortlessly appropriates the sun god's attributes. He calls himself the sun, that's S-U-N, the son of Babylon, who causes light to go forth over the lands of Sumer and Akkad, himself rising, quote, like the sun over the black-headed people, unquote, establishing law and justice in the language of the land. Now, our psalmist, the author of Psalm 19, however, is far from depicting the manner found in the iconography of the Hammurabi Code, or more strikingly, in the Sippar tablet relief, which we will see next. Ah, yes. This relief commemorated the restoration of the cult of Shamash, the sun god, during the reign of the Babylonian king Nabu-apal-Edina in 885 to 852 BCE. Now, the pertinent epigraph, which is located above the three figures off to the left, advancing towards Shamash, reads, "Image of the great Lord Shamash, who resides in the Ebabara in the midst of Sippar land." And in the middle of the relief is situated a large sun disk, suspended on a stand with four rays and four sets of wavy lines, apparently symbolizing the four quadrants of the earth, or perhaps the four cosmic rivers. Behind the disk stands, or to the right side of the disk, stands a canopy representing the vault of the highest heavens, within which the cult image of the sun itself is magnificently enthroned over the watery abyss, which is depicted by five parallel wavy lines there. The image of Shamash is depicted as a bearded figure, wearing a tiara with four rows of horns and holding the symbols of Babylonian rulership. Iconographically, the relief represents the distinction between the cult image enthroned within the canopy And the celestial orb or disc that is guided by reins held by a two-headed serpent man. Do you see him on top of the canopy on the left, uppermost left part? He holds the reins of the sun disc, clearly guiding its course across the heavens. And he is identified in the uppermost epigraph there on the upper right-hand side as the sun god's chief constable. In Psalm 19, there is no distinction between constable and cult image. It is Yahweh who sets the sun in its tent and along its ordained path. In contrast to Shamash of the Sippar relief that we see here, the sun in Psalm 19 resides only temporarily in a tent for its nocturnal repose and runs its heavenly trek, literally in the heat of the day. But the image of the tent connotes much more than simply temporary residence, the vestige of a Mesopotamian myth regarding the marriage of the sun. The sun bursts out from its wedding canopy, although strong evidence is hard to come by to make that case. But if so, the psalmist has charged Torah piety with potency, including even sexual potency. And so one can talk about the joy of Torah. But in so doing, the psalmist also has deployed these images, particularly the image of the tent, in a radically novel way. With his emphasis on the law, the central image of the sun's tent perhaps alludes also to the tent of the tabernacle, specifically the priestly tent of the testimony, the Ohel HaEdut, in which the ark and the tablets of the law were traditionally considered to be held. One can only speculate, but it is such speculation that is unavoidable and deliberately provoked by the psalmist's masterful use of metaphor. The psalm would not be complete without some overt reference to the individual, in this case, a petitioner. By no accident does the psalmist testify to being at once illumined and admonished by the precepts of the law, which glow with the light of the sun. Such searing enlightenment entails purgation. Following hard on the heels of verse 12 is the psalmist's fervent prayer that he or she be cleared of hidden thoughts, recalling the pure radiance of the sun which penetrates every hidden thing. In the light of the law, the psalmist is able to discern flaws undetectable by the human will alone. The supplicant's fervent hope is for a purified heart, more refined than fine gold, the crowning result of appropriating God's authoritative instruction. Through appropriation of the law, the petitioner is made complete, as blameless as the law is perfect. Through the juxtaposition of solar imagery and references to Torah, the sun is drawn into the purview of the law. Solarized worship of God is folded into the pages of Torah piety. The silent but visual voice of creation is subsumed under the spoken word of God, given voice in Torah. The psalmist boldly transfers a powerful cosmic image traditionally associated with temple worship and subsumes it under the ethos of Torah. But in so doing, the psalmist renders the verbal, written discourse of Torah with all of its ordinances, precepts, testimonies, and commandments. He renders them imagistically. They become now imagery. There is no harsh polemic here against sun worship, as some have tried to claim. As one scholar aptly notes, ostensible continuity between God and the sun is assumed, not negated, in this psalm. Although it needs to be said that the psalm is no longer identified with God, as we've seen elsewhere in the psalms. And demonstrating some measure of continuity between God and the sun, without identifying them together, is not the psalmist's paramount purpose, in my mind. It is simply presupposed. Above and beyond preserving the traditional linkage between God, temple, and solar image, the psalm enlists creation itself in its capacity to communicate God's glory, not in order to denigrate nature to ancillary status within the discursive framework of glory, but rather to elevate the significance of law for the reader, to underscore Torah's efficacy for the life of the individual and the community. However the psalm was historically produced and incorporated into the worship life of ancient Israel, I suspect it is a later psalm, like Psalm 1, that was produced when the temple no longer held such a strong unifying force within ancient Israel, perhaps within the exile, or probably more likely sometime during the Second Temple period, during the Persian period. But it is mute pretty much with regards to the temple. But in so doing, in muting the temple, it elevates the law. Well, however, that's all conjecture, but however that was done, however Psalm 19 was appropriated within the life and worship of ancient Israel, it does seem to have functioned decisively in the later life of the Jewish community at a time when the temple was no longer in existence. And we can find that on the floral mosaics of at least two early synagogues, which give silent visual testimony that Psalm 19 played a formative role in the worship life of Jews in Palestine. And the most dramatic example can be found in the 6th century synagogue mosaic at Beit Alpha. Slide, please. Now, here we find in the center of the pavement a breathtaking view of the cosmic order. Now, if you look up towards the middle, above the middle, you see this circle. And it is meant to be a view of the cosmic order. It is symbolized by the four seasons and the 12 signs of the zodiac. Let's get a closer look. Four seasons personified, 12 signs of the zodiac with images, all framing the sun, which our mosaicist did not hesitate to picture as the Greek sun god Helios in his chariot. Now, above this particular panel, and nearest to where the Torah shrine stood in this synagogue, are the symbols of the cultic order. Next slide. I could only get this one in black and white, so I apologize. Here, this particular panel stands above, or is laid above, so to speak, the solar disk that we found in the earlier slide. Here, we find the Torah ark flanked by two menorahs, as well as incense shovels, shofars, and other cultic accoutrements associated with temple worship. And of course, again, the temple no longer exists. This is a 6th century AD synagogue. The ark is also flanked by two lions who probably serve as metaphorical guardians. And unique to the mosaic of Beit Alpha is a lamp that hangs from the gabled roof. Do you see that there on top? Next slide. Now, there is one other mosaic from an earlier synagogue, Hamat Tiberias, which also features Helios surrounded by the zodiac. And here, Helios is holding the globe and a whip in his hand, the symbols associated with the Roman emperor, deified as Sol Invictus. Now, in both mosaics, in Hamat Tiberias and in Beit Alpha, the zodiac wheel with the figure of Helios, the Greek sun god, at its center, no doubt was controversial and even offended some Jews. Again, these are within synagogues. The images and arrangement of the solar chariot, the zodiac wheel, and the personified seasons are taken directly from paganism and reflects Greco-Roman assimilation of Babylonian astrology. But we read in the Babylonian Talmud, which states, "There is no planetary luck or fate in Israel." And yet, is that not what we have featured here in full display in these synagogues? An ornate model of the zodiac and all of its astrological wonder? Theories abound about whether the zodiac featured in these synagogues represents a need to adapt the Hebrew calendar to the solar year, or that it represents creeping astrological and magical practices within rabbinic Judaism. But I have another idea. Surprise. A close comparison with Psalm 19 suggests that more than syncretism is at work in these on these ancient synagogue floors. What I find missing in many scholarly analyses that try to take into account the significance of these pagan motifs in Jewish synagogues, what I find missing among them is the larger framework in which such images have been set. As in Psalm 19, we find on the floor mosaic sun and Torah tightly juxtaposed. Even here, you can see the Torah arc above the mosaic of the sun. Indeed, direct or rather indirect confirmation of such association is given in a piece of rabbinic midrash called Numbers Rabbah, which refers to the chariot mentioned in the Song of Songs as signifying, quote, the sun which is set on high and rides on a chariot, lighting up the world as it is written in Psalm 19, and he is a bridegroom coming out of his canopy. In other words, in Psalm 19, the rabbis found a biblical precedent for associating the celestial orb and God's authoritative instruction, or Torah. Can that not also be said, then, of our mosaicists, or at least those who commissioned them for these synagogues? Yes, the details are pagan, the zodiac and the chariot, but the framework is thoroughly biblical. In both the psalm and the mosaics, word and world, sun and Torah are brought together. Now, it must be said that Psalm 19 does not allude to the binding of Isaac, which was featured in the Beit Alpha mosaic. Let's take a look at the next slide. Yeah, that's the bottom panel of the Beit Alpha mosaic. We have three panels here. Above this, of course, is the sun zodiac imagery, and above that is the Torah imagery. But this is the bottom panel. We don't find the story of Isaac in the story of Genesis 22 featured in our psalm, I'm sorry to say. And that may be a problem. But worthy of note is that the Genesis 22 story, the story of the binding of Isaac by Abraham, is intentionally separated from the other two panels in our Beit Alpha synagogue. The upper two panels are more closely related. There is a division. You can see the sort of looks like elongated asterisks on top. That separates this panel from the two panels which are more tightly connected in Beit Alpha. But the story of Genesis 22, known among Jews as the Akedah story, does serve to recreate something of the setting of the temple to which the synagogue itself is oriented. If you recall, in the story of Genesis 22, it takes place on an unnamed mountain in the land of Moriah, which, according to the chronicler, is also where Solomon built his temple and the site which David had acquired from the Jebusites. In later biblical lore and rabbinic tradition, the Akedah story, the Isaac story, came to serve as a foundational narrative for temple worship. Next slide. Because we also see here in the Torah alcove of the Dora Europa synagogue in Syria, built in the 3rd century AD, we find here a depiction of the same biblical scene flanking the Torah shrine and opposite an elaborate menorah. You can see it in the upper right-hand corner. There you see the sacrificial scene depicted in Genesis 22. Take my word for it. It's there. Like Dura Europus 3 centuries earlier, the synagogue mosaic of Beit Alpha has incorporated the sacrificial context of temple worship into the fold of Torah piety, which the biblical tradition itself facilitates by lifting up Abraham as the exemplar of incomparable obedience and faith. Indeed, its inclusion in this cosmic scene in the mosaics completes the same rhetorical movement one finds in Psalm 19, namely the movement from the cosmos to the moral integrity of the individual. Abraham is the model of moral integrity in Scripture, the model of righteousness par excellence, who serves as the exemplar for the individual petitioner, who cries out to God, "Clear me from my hidden sins." Now, I cannot help but also add from personal experience an equally dramatic example that illustrates the relationship between sun and Torah, one that is experienced by almost every tourist and pilgrim who has had opportunity to visit the traditional site of Mount Sinai near St. Catherine's Monastery in the southern part of the peninsula. Visitors typically begin the arduous ascent of Jebel Musha, the mountain of Moses, hours before, usually between 3 and 4 a.m., before daybreak, in order to witness the sunrise at the top of Mount Sinai. And there at the summit, at the first light of dawn, as the sun begins to break through and penetrate the darkness, one will invariably hear in various languages pilgrims reciting this particular psalm: as the sun's rays burst upon the rugged place where supposedly Moses received the Torah on the mountain of the law. It's a wonderful experience if you ever get a chance to do that. What's also a bit shocking is once you reach the top, you find yourself among at least 500 other people. As the sun once illumined the sacred precincts of Zion, the temple, at the break of day, symbolizing the coming of God's glory in residence at the temple, so the sun continues to radiate the mountain of the law at the dawn of each new day. Lights, please. In conclusion, Psalm 19 is a sound and light show. It is a poetic tour de force that brings together image and word and records the explosive reaction that ensues. The 19th Psalm exhibits complex metaphorical reaction, interreaction, whereby the boundaries that delineate the metaphor from the object, the vehicle from the tenor, is deliberately broken down. In other words, sun and Torah are mutually related. One informs and shapes the contours of the other. Through the filter of Torah, the sun is rendered as a model of Torah piety. At the same time, Torah is giving nothing sort of cosmic legitimacy in this psalm. Torah is made radiant, transformed into a veritable effulgence of jurisprudence. Torah is solarized and made mythic in stature. Again, a double movement is at work in the readerly process. You have to read forward as well as backward. And on a more existential level, this double movement broadens the horizons of the moral self and at the same time familiarizes the realm of the other. The moral integrity of the individual is shown to have cosmic implications, and the realm of the transcendent is found to be intimately related to the faithful conduct of the righteous. Which is the tenor and which is the vehicle in this metaphorical interaction? As the sun is viewed through the lens of Torah, word interprets world. And as Torah is given cosmological grounding, the world in turn has a hand in shaping and broadening the word. As the sun bursts out from its canopy to cover the extremities of heaven, so according to the prophet Isaiah, Torah shall go forth out of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem for all nations. Isaiah 2, verse 3. It is no accident that Martin Luther saw in the image of the sun profiled in Psalm 19 the sun bursting forth from its wedding canopy. Martin Luther saw in that image a missiological statement, a message that the gospel is sure to spread to the ends of the earth, even despite our efforts. As sure as the sun rises, so the good news extends its arms to embrace the world. What a vision. Through the written word, the world is revealed as the theater of God's glory, to borrow from Calvin. But one need also add that through the world and all of its unsettled glory and terrible beauty, the word is shown to be the catalyst of creation, both old and new, the genesis of cosmos and community. As the heavens declare God's glory and instruction, so Torah imparts God's handiwork within the very crucible of human identity, a creatio continuata in miniature, with the sun traversing its cosmic circuits and Torah reviving the soul. The community is nurtured like a tree planted beside flowing streams, basking in the light of the sun in God's cosmic temple. The sun of righteousness that has risen from the tomb to bring us into the womb of new life. Amen.